This is the Dharma Podcast at dharmapodcast.org, and this is show number 108 with Chetsunma Tenzin Palmo, titled, The Value of the Contemplative Life.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'm amazed that so many people. I was expecting about 20. So it's lovely to see you all here. I think I will just speak a little bit, and then I will open it up to questions. Personally, I prefer having a question-answer kind of format, because then, first of all, it stretches me a bit. You know, people ask questions I never thought about. And also it gives one more of an indication of what you're really interested in. But I will start, because the title is something about the value of the contemplative life. Right. You know, to be honest, I'm always somewhat in conflict. When people, you know, because the thing is that normally the Buddhist texts are directed towards monks, nuns, and hermits. In other words, they're directed towards sort of spiritual professionals who have nothing to do but to practice and study. And so when people ask me how important I think it is to do intense retreats and to devote much of their day to actual orthodox practice, then, as I say, I'm a little bit in conflict because I don't want to discourage people. So therefore, I go around the world talking about how to make our daily life into our spiritual practice. Because I think this is also true. I think that if one just thinks that Dharma practice is when you're sitting on your cushion and then the rest of the day is so much worldly activity, then there's never going to be a chance to really blend the Dharma with our lives and our minds and really transform. But at the same time, if one doesn't give sufficient time to formal practice, it is also difficult to get to that point where one really can merge the Dharma with one's daily life. I have this friend, this young friend, he's Australian, and now he's sort of in his mid-20s. And since I've known him when he was a little boy, he's been absolutely in love with the guitar, and he plays the Spanish and classical guitar. And since I've known him as a little boy, he would be spending 6 to 8 hours a day practicing his guitar, so that now he's really a very brilliant guitarist. He's wonderful. But it's because he devoted so much of his time to it, and because he loves it so much. If he only gave half an hour a day to twiddling around a bit, I mean, he would still be going plunk, plunk, plunk. And that's just playing the guitar. What to speak of enlightenment? And so this is the thing. I mean, you know, like, if you want to excel at anything, you know, if you want to be a first-rate football player, one has to be willing to, you know, renounce so many things in life and really focus one's attention on, you know, on perfecting one's play and exercising and eating the right kind of foods and and living the right kind of life regime in order to excel at one's sport, or one's art, or one's music, or anything. I mean, even computer geeks. I mean, they spend, you know, endless hours in front of the computer in order to become really, really proficient at what they're interested in. And so if even very, you know, worldly skills require so much dedication, then what is it to transform our whole being from, you know, worldly perceptions to genuine enlightened seeing? How is it that we think it's not going to require too much effort? You know, we are all creatures of habit. And some of our habits are good habits, and some of our habits are not so good. But to really transform ourselves, to really, you know, what the Lankavatara Sutta says, to turn around in the seat of the consciousness, requires tremendous dedication. How do we think it doesn't? So, I mean, if one looks at the great masters in the past, and this is why I'm not trying to discourage you, but if one looks at the great masters in the past, then one sees that they devoted enormous amounts of time just to one-pointed practice. So even if we don't have the time and the opportunities for that, nonetheless, we really have to find ways to put the Dharma at the center of our lives and not just at the periphery. Otherwise, the years go by and nothing really changes. Now, of course, the good news is that inherently we are already Buddhas. So on one level, we don't have to create something which is not there. You know, and it's not that Asians are more Buddhas than Westerners. You know, we're all just, you know, we all have this inner potential. It's there the whole time, just waiting for us to recognize it, really. And this is not a Dharma talk which a Roshi can very well give you. I'm not doing that. What I'm trying to do here is just to explore the possibilities of a real inner transformation in people who are not full-time, you know, nothing else to do except do practice types. Now, so how to do this? First of all, of course, it is very useful, if you possibly can, to undergo certain periods of intense meditation retreats with good guidance. I mean, we all know that if we want to excel at any skill, it saves time and error if we have a proficient teacher. I mean, even if we want to learn to play the piano, you go and get a piano teacher. I mean, so it's obvious that if we really want to learn how to meditate properly, it saves a lot of time and frustration if we have good teachers. So you are very fortunate, because here there are good teachers. And not only that, but they speak your language. And they understand your mind. So that's a huge, huge advantage. I think it is very important to do intense meditation retreats, at least from time to time, because that gives one, it gives one the opportunity to get a taste of what we're talking about. And that taste of what we're talking about is a tremendous incentive. Because sometimes we think, oh, you know, yeah, well, the great masters in the past, they could do these things, they could realize these things, but me, I can't do that. I'm just a very ordinary person, and it's beyond my abilities. So if we do some really well-directed, intense practice, we begin to say, no, that's not true. We have the potential, just as everybody else did. Look, you know, that actually, I experienced that. That was me experiencing that. I mean, you know, relatively speaking. And it encourages us to realize that actually it's not as difficult. It just needs application. And then when we get that taste, then we can take that into our everyday lives. Because the really important thing in the end is indeed to use our everyday life, our relationships, our family, our friends, our colleagues, everyone we meet, and every breath we take as a practice. So that there isn't this, you know, Dharma here and everyday life there, sort of looking at each other. They have to blend, otherwise nothing changes. I mean, we were talking at a retreat I gave just now about how it is that sometimes people have been practicing for years and years and they seem to end up worse than when they started. And not everybody, fortunately. but why? What has gone wrong? And I think, you know, I don't know exactly, but I think what goes wrong, especially in the Tibetan tradition, what goes wrong is that there's so much information to take in. And it just sits up there in the head, you know, and you get more and more and more and more information, and it's all up here, and none of it goes down into the heart. So, you know, all that happens is that it just inflates the sense of ego and how clever we are. We know all the names of all the lineages and all the practices and every lama. And nothing actually moves down here. But the whole point is to move something here. You can feel a shift. And if one doesn't feel that shift, then it's not working. I mean, ultimately, we have to become our practice. It's not that, you know, there's the practice and the person practicing, and they're sort of like two mountains facing each other. Our minds and the practice have to merge together, and when it merges together, something really, really transforms inside ourselves. And we have to keep practicing and keep trying to bring ourselves back into the present, whatever we're doing, wherever we are. And opening the heart. So basically, all we have to do is to do occasionally some really strong practices with good guidance, and then take that into our lives and to really try to practice being centered, being present, and opening the heart to realize that every single being we meet, everybody, in their heart of hearts, just wants to be happy. They don't want to be hurt. They don't want to suffer. And just as we want to be happy and we don't want to suffer, every single being is like that. So get out the way and just look at them. And if we can do that in our life as much as possible, not just, you know, with our families, with our dear ones, with our friends, with our colleagues, with people we're just meeting, shopkeepers, waiters, I know, other drivers, each one to them, their own self, as the Buddha said, to each one his own self is most dear. And just as we think ourselves so precious, so every being thinks themselves so precious, and we respect that. And we realize that for each one, their own self wants happiness, they don't want suffering. So we have to be very, very alert and careful as much as possible that everybody we meet, we wish them well and we don't create any problems for them. Now, if we do that in our daily life, that alone keeps us quite busy. And the point is that, you know, the Buddha himself, you know, talked about generosity and ethics and loving kindness and compassion and many qualities of the heart. Many qualities of the heart. And so the heart has to be involved in this. Boundless compassion, because everybody, we're all trapped together. And just as we would like to be happier and more centered and more peaceful, so everybody. But the problem is, because of our delusion, that even we want to be happy, we create so many problems for ourselves and for others. Look at the world. I mean, the world is the way it is because it is governed and run by people who are so confused, who are dominated by the negative emotions, and who don't have wisdom, usually. So now we're hoping things will change. But we don't know. We wait and see. Anyway, the point is, yes, the contemplative life does have value. And as Roshi said, you know, the contemplative life is breathing in, and our active life, interrelating with other beings, is breathing out. And we need both. We need to breathe in, but we also need to breathe out, and we need to breathe in, and we need to breathe out. And then when the two just merge together, breathing in, breathing out, then we are healthy. Then we are healthy. But if we're always breathing out or we're only breathing in, then we're out of balance. So all of you, you have this challenge now to use your life in a way which is really meaningful. And I always say you can tell whether you're doing okay by what does your family say. I mean, are your family happy that you're interested in Dharma? Oh, they say, oh God, that again. You know, because they are the judges. You know, are you actually a nicer person? More patient, more good-hearted, more open, or not? They're the judges. And in our practice, we have to really look. It's no good looking at everybody else. You know, it's very easy to see other people's problems. The thing is to look into ourselves and see, you know, really now I have been practicing for this long, am I genuinely better for it? Paldana Tisha, who was a great Bengali pundit who went to Tibet in the 11th century, he said that if we were in retreat for, say, a year, when we come out, the question to ask ourselves is not what great experiences we had or what realizations or any of all that. Are the three negative emotions, our, you know, basic ego delusion, and from that our greed and our aversion, are they less, more, or the same? And if our negative emotions are the same or even worse, then that whole retreat was a waste of time. And the only criteria is, have our negative emotions subsided somewhat? Then, yes, that retreat was useful. And so, you know, we have to look at ourselves. You know, are we actually nicer people? Are we kinder? Are we more patient? Are we more generous? Are we spontaneously more humorous? Do we take things very hard? Are we tighter? Are we looser? Are we more centered? Do we go up and down? Or are we a little bit more balanced? You know, we have to ask ourselves these questions. Are we still totally ego-absorbed? Or do we genuinely think more about others than ourselves? So this is the thing. It's not just about, you know, incredible meditational experiences. It's really about whether or not our practice really and truly helps us to be better human beings on this planet. Kinder, more thoughtful. It's not very exciting and it's not very exotic, but it's what counts. Otherwise, we just end up a bunch of very selfish, self-absorbed, I don't know what. You know, sitting on our cushion, totally absorbed in ourselves. We should only be absorbed in ourselves in order to see through the delusion of ourselves. And from that, to open up the heart to include all beings. If it just stops at me, then it's no use. I mean, when one meets great practitioners, the first thing that strikes one is how open-hearted they are, how totally non-judgmental, how they are completely accepting of whoever they meet, just as they are, with great love, like a mother for her child. And so we have to ask ourselves, are we feeling like that towards all beings or not? A little bit. Then the contemplative life has meaning. But if it just makes us more egoic and more selfish and more self-absorbed, really, honestly, it's a waste of time. This is not what the Buddha meant. So, each of us has to be honest and you know, get feedback from your family, okay? Ask your partners and your children and so forth what they really honestly think about, you know, how you're doing. Also, the Dharma should lighten our lives, right? It should be like yeast in heavy dough. You know, if you've got dough, it's very heavy, it's just sort of sitting there, and you mix it with even a little bit of yeast, it all puffs up. And so the Dharma should be like that for us too. It should lighten our lives. It shouldn't be another extra burden. Some people, they really carry the Dharma around like it's a, you know, rucksack full of, backpack full of rocks. You know, it makes life more difficult. But really the Dharma should make life very much more allegro, you know, bright, happy. I sometimes think that a sense of humor should be the seventh paramita, you know? Because we tend to take ourselves very seriously. And so love, you know, be light also. The Dharma should make our lives brighter and clearer. It shouldn't be an added complication. Anyway, I mean, I'm just waffling on. Does anybody have any questions?
I was wondering if you could say something about your evolution that you noticed in yourself through the stages of being a retreat for some
while. You know, to tell you the truth, the time I spent in the cave seems like a past lifetime. I hardly remember anymore. I remember shoveling off snow, and that's my most vivid recollection of all those years. But, I mean, you know, after having been for those years in retreat, which was a very wonderful time, I was very happy. This time of going around the world so often, trying to raise interest in the plight of nuns, and starting the nunnery and trying to get that running happily, has been a great learning experience for me. I must say, I wouldn't have chosen it, but as it got chosen, it's been really a wonderful learning experience, because as I say, there are so many qualities which we need to develop for the Dharma path. And sometimes when you're just sitting in solitude, you don't really have the opportunity to practice them. And when you're out in the world dealing with everything, including Indian officials, you have a wonderful opportunity for practice. And so basically I think it's good. But now I really would like to start breathing in again.
How did you get along in the cave again without a concern for your health? So many of us spend so much time and money on our health. You know, it can be almost a full-time job. And when I read the account of your life in the cave, you didn't seem to have that fear that most of us have of ill health.
You know, my feeling is that whatever happens, one will just deal with it when it happens. You know, I mean, the Tibetans have a saying, "Na na na ji na ji," which means if you're sick, you're sick, and if you die, you die. Which I think summed up my attitude. So, when I was sick, I waited, and either I got better or I didn't. It's very simple. And pain itself can be a great meditation, especially when there's no painkillers. And you just have to watch the pain and see that it is just sensations and so forth. I mean, I don't know. I have at this point a mind which just, takes it as it comes. And if something bad happens, I'll deal with it when it happens. What's the use of worrying beforehand? You know? Otherwise, you don't appreciate what you've got while you've got it. Because you're always worrying about what might be happening next, and who knows? You know, I mean, that seems so foolish. And Shanti Davis said, you know, if you can deal with it, why worry? And if you can't deal with it, what's the use of worrying? Isn't it? You know? Because it's just another habit of mind, you know, that we start worrying about the future. Well, who knows what the future is going to do? I mean, the point is right now, in this moment, how are we dealing with what is happening right now? And honestly, if one has that inner stability right now, whatever happens in the future, you'll deal with it. Of course you will. Isn't it? You know? So while you're happy, you're happy. While you're sad, you're sad. When you're well, you're well. When you're sick, you're sick. It's a what? This is samsara. Isn't it? I mean, the Buddha said something about dukkha. I mean, dukkha's no problem unless you say it's a problem. Isn't it?
You mentioned before that each expertise takes a lot of practice. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to become a guitarist, obviously you play the guitar every day. Those three things you mentioned as a barometer, whether the intensive practice has been successful or not, becoming generally more interested in people, more patient, listening better, managing your emotions and so forth. All those things are things that relate to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So in an interplay with another person. Now how would you expect to become better at that if you spend a year, 2 years, 12 years, whatever, in a cave on your own? There is nobody to interact with other than yourself.
Ah! But that's the whole point. When you have nobody to when you're alone, right? Now, all right, I'm here, and then I feel agitated, I feel upset, I feel depressed. What do? I turn on the television, I pick up the telephone, I go off to see my best friend. Anything to escape from that painful feeling. When you're by yourself, all alone, the painful feeling arises, there's nowhere to go. There's no escape. So you have to look at that painful feeling, face that painful feeling, maybe see the essential transparency of that feeling, but anyway, you have to deal with it. And that's how we learn. But then also we can come out and see, have we really learned that lesson? So, I mean, the one person that we need to have the most patience, understanding, loving kindness and compassion towards, to begin with, is ourselves. Because for so many people, the one person they don't have loving kindness and compassion towards is themselves. And so first we have to make friends with ourselves and deal with our own problems, and then we can go out and use that understanding and that maturity in dealing with others, isn't it?
Anila, can you talk about the lessening of afflictive emotions? Are you talking about the internal experience of those emotions or the acting out of those emotions, or both? And how do those two things interact?
I think both. Somebody annoys us because they're doing what we don't want them to do, so that pushes our buttons. So first of all, is one spontaneous reaction irritation and annoyance, or is it spontaneously a patience or seeing the empty nature of the emotion, right? From that, if we really are out of control, then we will express that anger. But the thing is, somebody annoys me, what is my immediate reaction? You know, and or with anything. You see an article which is very pleasing, then is one's immediate reaction, wow, I want that, you know, and or is it just seeing, oh, that's a pleasing article, but without the desire to grasp it, and so forth. And how much is one's everyday thoughts revolving around oneself, and how much is it actually also open to the fact that we're sharing this planet with so many others? You know, I feel this, I think that, I want this, I don't want that. When you meet somebody, are you worrying about what they're thinking about you? Or have you stepped out the way and you're just interested in them? You know, we can look. Isn't it? I mean, this is the point. The point is that it's all a mind training also. Of course, you know, ultimately we're trying to say, you know, the nature of the mind. And to see that all these emotions and all these feelings and all these thoughts are empty in their nature. But even without that, we should be able to learn how to apply antidotes so that we don't suppress the emotions, but that we use that emotion and transform it into something positive instead of just giving vent endlessly to our negativities out of control. Isn't it?
What can replace consumption in my life? My wife and I can now have like 150 yard sales every weekend, and we keep purchasing crap. It's all crap. I know that, but how do I control money?
I think the first step you've already taken, because you've already admitted that there's a problem. And that what you're doing is basically a waste of time. So I would say the next thing is when you reach out to buy something or get something, to say, stop! And instead of looking out, look in. You know? and see, well, look, I've done this before. It doesn't lead to anything. It's a complete waste of time. What am I doing? This is just stupid. Let's do something better. You know? I mean, only you can stop yourself. Nobody else can stop you. I mean, we all have good habits and bad habits. And in the end, we have to be in charge of our own life. You know? Otherwise, we're like, well, like little children who, you know, are happy, 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 and they're laughing, laughing, or sad, sad, sad when they're thwarted, and they have no control. You know, but that's when you're 2 years old, not when, you know, you're grown up. You know, I mean, by our age, we should have at least some basic control.
Don't forget, humankind is now you're supposed to be.
But I am being kind because I'm reprimanding you, and that is very great kindness at this point.
From your own experience, how did you become convinced that there's an afterlife?
Oh, you know, I was brought up as a spiritualist. Which means that in our house, every week, we had seances. And so we were endlessly discussing things with the spirit guides. And I mean, I saw, you know, tables, big tables, with a huge big lady on top of it sailing around the room. And all sorts of phenomena and whatever. So since I could think, I had always believed that our consciousness goes on. In fact, ever since I was a small child, I remember saying to my mother, asking my mother if she thought we came back again and again. And she said she thought that sounded sensible, and I thought so too. So, I have always believed in rebirth. But, you know, when you see, for example, in the Tibetan tradition, there's no way you can prove it or disprove it, right? I mean, basically. If you want to believe it, you believe it. If you don't want to believe it, you don't. It matters, but not so much. But if you meet, for example, you know, the Tibetans have this custom of recognizing the incarnations of previous lamas, like the Dalai Lama's the 14th. So they have hundreds and hundreds of these. And some people say that, oh, well, of course, you know, these lamas are special because they're taken when they're very young and they're very specially trained. So anybody would be special if they got that kind of training. But if you meet these these young lamas before anybody has discovered them, when they're like about 2 or 3 years old, then you see that these children are not anything like ordinary children. They really are not like ordinary children. And you think, who is that? And sometimes they declare themselves, you know. I mean, for example, the head of my tradition, when I first knew him, he was 2 years old, 2.5. And he was already in robes, with a shaved head, because he said to his parents that, I'm a monk, why you keep dressing me like a layperson? So they said, all right. So then they shaved his head, put on robes. And he said to his mother, I am a monk, I cannot sleep with a woman. So they made him his little own little bed, you know, so he didn't sleep with his mother anymore. And one time I went to see his father, who I knew, and he had said that the day before, there were these sacks of rice, a couple of sacks of rice, and the little boy had taken a towel and climbed up on the sacks of rice, put the towel down, sat on it, and said to his father and mother, I'm a very high lama, you don't know who I am, but it would be for your benefit to make prostrations and offerings. I don't know who this kid is, but he's somebody. And of course, in time, he was recognized as Gyawang Drukpa, who's the head of my tradition. But like that is very common. I mean, you see these little ones when they're small. And also his father said to me, is it normal for a three-year-old to go and sit on a rock and stare out into space for hours? And I said, probably not. So, anyway. The thing with believing in past and future lives is that it puts this lifetime into perspective. This lifetime is a result of everything we have done before, and how we use this lifetime now will set the tone for our future lives. So we should be very, very careful with this lifetime that we use it meaningfully so that it is set in the direction we would like to go in the future. And that gives a vast canvas instead of something very small, you know?
Mm. Can you talk a little bit about your nunnery?
Oh, my nunnery. Well, my lama had asked me if I would start a nunnery, and I didn't really quite know what to do with that, and I left it. But then in the early 2000s, when after living up in the cave, I went and stayed in Italy for a few years. Then I came back to India, and the Lama said, look, you should start something for women, because in our tradition there isn't anything. And I thought, well, this is true. If I don't do it, they won't. So after that, I began traveling around, trying to get people interested in the plight of nuns, because traditionally, nuns were not educated, and often they were not given the higher teachings. They were really often just household servants or servants to the monks. They didn't have the opportunities that the monks had. And now, gradually, this view of women as being inferior and not capable is changing. And so now there are some quite nice nunneries. I mean, they're, of course, nothing compared to the monasteries, but they're a whole lot better than they used to be. So I started a nunnery, and in our nunnery, it's for girls from Tibet and from the Himalayan regions. And they study, of course, first they study Tibetan and English, and then they do philosophical studies. They also have a two-month silent retreat every year. We now have five nuns in a three-year retreat. They also, of course, learn ritual, which is important. But mostly they learn also philosophy and debating. And we are hopeful that in the future, some of them themselves, well, already they are becoming teachers. Some of our senior nuns are now teaching newcomers. They're teaching philosophy and Tibetan and so forth. And we hope with some in my monastery. The important thing in our monastery, which is 10 minutes from us, are this group of monks who are yogis. They're called Togden. And they follow the Milarepa tradition. And so in Tibet, they lived in caves. And we have a whole new lot of Togdens coming up, many of whom I haven't seen for 15 years or more. I mean, the analogy which always comes to my mind is that you have some dough with the yeast in it, and you put it in the oven, you turn the heat up, and then you don't take the dough out until it's risen and cooked. Because if you take out, you know, the bread when it's only half baked, then, of course, it will just collapse and be disgusting. And you have to wait for it to really cook all the way through. When it's cooked all the way through, then you take it out and it's very delicious and very nourishing. So these monks are in retreat for 15, 18, 20 years before they are regarded as being fully cooked. In other words, it's not just a matter of getting realization of the nature of the mind, but that realization has to be completely stabilized so that they don't collapse. And so this very precious tradition which we have, my Lama Khamtra Rinpoche had very formally said to me, well, in Tibet we had many of these females, these Togden Ma, But that tradition now has died out since the Tibetans left Tibet. And so I always pray that you will renew this very precious female lineage which has died out. So one of the main reasons for the nunnery is to try to train girls to eventually become Togden Ma. And so we have not only they study philosophy, but they do the retreats. And then we're hoping, we have a retreat center, and we're hoping that, of course it takes time, but in the future a few of them will really train. Because in Tibetan Buddhism there are very few women teachers. And examples, you know, for women.
What's the location?
It's in Himachal Pradesh. It's about 2 hours from Dharamshala, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives.
Like Tilokpur?
It's about 3 or 4 hours from Tilokpur.
What feelings might you have today after the election returns last night?
Well, we hope that now there will be the opportunity for America and for the rest of the world to take a more positive direction. I mean, the opportunity is there. Whether or not it is actually realized depends on many, many causes. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think that for many people it was a great sense of relief that maybe now there is the opportunity to go in a different direction.
So let's say you get to a point in your practice where you feel like you may be having some experiences, but then you feel like you also have the, you're not doing so well with the patients, and you have a lot of the grasping going on still. Do you just advise going back to square one, or do you like stopping any of the practices you're doing and just bring yourself back to like a really basic practice?
Well, I think that's something which you alone can make the decision, but sometimes it doesn't hurt to go back again. You know, it's like if you're trying to learn how to play a particularly difficult sonata, sometimes it just goes better down, get back to some basic finger exercises. But the thing is also that one should have tremendous compassion also to oneself. You know, I mean, we are very harsh on ourselves. It's a tricky thing because on the one hand we're too harsh, on the other hand too lenient. And just feeling angry and frustrated with oneself because one isn't perfect is not the point. Because obviously, if we were perfect, we wouldn't need the Buddha Dharma. We'd already be Buddhas. And so the fact that we do have faults and problems is actually our opportunity, you know? Because if we didn't have any faults, then we wouldn't have anything to work on. And the fact that we do have faults is our opportunity to really learn and develop. For example, in our monastery, there was one of our yogis who, the main thing you noticed about him was how absolutely loving he was, and his eyes just sparkled with kindness, and everybody loved him. And I was told that when he was younger, he had a big problem with temper, and he was very angry type, and very uptight, and very, very difficult. And people said to him, look, either you become a yogi or, you know, maybe you should leave the monastery. You're really obnoxious. And as a result, he really, you know, worked on that. You know, right, I'm bad-tempered and angry. This is my practice. And so he transformed completely into this absolutely ball of love and light, you know. And so the thing is that our true nature is totally loving and totally wise. So we're not trying to develop something which we don't have. What we're trying to do is to get back to our original nature. And so wherever we have difficulties, that's the part which we need to work on. And so far from despairing, we should feel, oh, good, now I know. You know, I'm really horrible when somebody talks like this or in these kind of situations. You know, it really presses my buttons. So this is where I'm going to work. I mean, this is the whole point. You know, you can't develop, for example, patience if you don't have people who annoy you. Isn't it? So instead of being upset with people who annoy you, you can feel grateful. Because they're our teachers. You know, they're teaching us to be patient. Because if you don't have anyone who presses your buttons, how are you going to learn? So in that way, instead of just feeling more and more frustrated, one should realize that these are endless. I mean, if we say it's a problem, it's a problem. If we say it's an opportunity, it's an opportunity. And that's that. So be happy. So, yes. Well, I think we've sort of come up. All right, one last question. Yes. How to keep one's practice light? I think, first of all, not to take oneself too seriously. I mean, I really think that sometimes when we people are on a spiritual trip end up taking themselves really very, you know, getting so very self-absorbed. So it's very good to get oneself out of the way. I mean, on one hand, when you're sitting in meditation, yes, of course, then you can look at the mind. But the rest of the time, even though one is being conscious and present, at the same time, one should realize that, you know, ultimately, it's all empty. You know, I don't mean that just in a philosophical sense. You know, we make things very, very solid and opaque, including our thoughts. But really, it's very open and spacious. And we should really try to make our minds more open and spacious as well as centered. And if we can do that, then that brings a lightness, you know, and laugh at oneself, you know. It's not a matter of chastising or taking oneself too seriously. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous when you look at it. And so keep that lightness there, you know. Don't take it. I mean, on the one hand, you have to be very, very sincere. But not too serious. Okay, I think we have to end here. Yes? So, my assistant Leslie has just a very short announcement to make.
Hi, everybody. On behalf of Jetsun, I'd just like to thank Roshi Joan Halifax and Upaya for inviting us here. It's really quite lovely. So we don't often get to speak at Dharma centers, so it's really nice to be here. So, and luckily for me, both Jetsuna and Roshi Joan talked about the nunnery already. So now I'll just tell you a little bit about how you can contribute to it if you like. The as is in most monastic communities, the yes. Better. I was just talking about if you're interested in contributing to the nunnery and its buildings and its daily the operations, as well as maybe supporting a nun, which is only $1 a day. We've got three different ways to do it. On your seat right now, there's a Donna envelope, which is self-explanatory. At the front, we have some self-addressed envelopes that go to New York, which is an organization, a new nonprofit organization that was developed for Jetsuma, called Friends of Donju Getso Ling, which is the name of her nunnery, Donju Getso Ling. So if you'd like to take an envelope from the front and donate later, that's fine. And then the third way is on her website, which is tenzinhomo.com, and there's a click and pledge option. And you can learn lots more about the nunnery and its comings and goings. On her website, it's really quite a beautiful website. And then outside of that, we've also placed on your seats just an email list. If you're interested, please fill it out. And twice a year, the nunnery and Jatsuna create a beautiful newsletter, including a teaching from Jatsuna and just some of the information about what's happening at the nunnery. Right now, they're almost finished building. They're at their the last building, which is the temple. And so they've created for you, for anybody, a wish list just to give you an idea about what they're still trying to manifest.
All our desires.
Yes. Yes, and so the wish list is also at the front if you want to take a look at that. And it's really concrete things, and you can check off what it is that you would like to donate specifically. So, again, thank you very much.
So thank you very much, all of you, and of course especially thank you to Roshi John Halifax for inviting me here. And it's been wonderful to talk to you, and I appreciate your questions and your attention. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.